Welcome to the Next Regeneration Podcast by the Osteology Foundation. We feature hot topics and novel perspectives, always with relevance to the dental career and practice. Join our hosts, Anina and Elena, as they speak with new guests from around the world each month and learn more about what's important for the next generation in oral regeneration.
Hello and welcome back to our podcast. Today we want to talk about the fascinating topic of plated concentrates. We will discuss their definition, development, rationale for using them. We also look at the key components and key issues to consider when it comes to blood-derived products. For this interesting discussion, I'm very excited to introduce our esteemed guest who has extensive research experience in this field, and I'm also particularly eager to hear his insights and opinions on the various products. Right, Elena?
Oh, yes, Anina. I am also very thrilled to welcome our guest for today's podcast, who is Professor Reinhard Gruber, a true expert when it comes to basic research. Reinhard is professor of oral biology at University Clinic of Dentistry in Vienna, and he has published a large number of highly cited, I would say, scientific works on plated concentrates. And his valuable insights have significantly contributed to our understanding of the mechanism of action of blood-derived products, but also on their limitations. So without further ado, a very warm welcome, Reinhard, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It's an honor and a pleasure. And I have to tell my mother that I'm in a broadcast. She will be very proud.
You have to do that, absolutely, Reinhard. Also from my side, hello.
Hello.
So during our pre-chat, I remember very well, we had an insightful conversation about the history of plated concentrate and also how it started more than 30 years ago with PRP, the first generation product, and then it moved to PRF, second generation. And Reinhard, can you give us some insights about when it started with the PRP and how it developed over the years?
Actually, before I answer this question, I have to give credits to other people in the PRF field, no? Because actually this is a community and a group approach. And I guess if someone speaks, he or she might speak on behalf of this, let's say, PRF community. And I think Mark Quirinen, Richard Myron, Joseph Shokron, Sharam Ganati are opinion leaders, and they should be recognized and give credits.
Absolutely.
And from my group, Sarah and Leila, we have done together all the research in Vienna. So thanks, colleagues, for all your valuable contribution. And now, the question about the history, how it all started. And I remember the days when George Watzek called me in his office and said, Reinhard, I think we have to work with PRP. There is a paper out from Robert Marx, and they have shown that platelet products somehow support bone regeneration. And so we were carefully reading his publication, and actually the data were supporting the use based on radiographs and some histologies, so surrogate parameters, what we would say today. But it was somehow convincing. But if you read carefully, that was in 1998. Mm-hmm. They have isolated the PRP with machines used in hematology, in transfusion medicine. So they took 400 to 450 milliliter of blood, citrated blood, no, so anticoagulated blood, to prepare overall 70 milliliter of PRP. And the remaining erythrocytes and other cells, they went back to the patients. So a very, let's say, demanding procedure. And of course, this PRP, they put together with bone grafts and thrombin and calcium and get the kind of PRF gel. And this was more or less the pioneer work. But you can already imagine that this is not an easygoing procedure for a dental office, no? Quite expensive. Mm-hmm. And so you need a kind of clinical background to do that. So, but nevertheless, in Vienna, we started research doing PRP research, and we showed quite nicely that this PRP can support osseointegration integration and has a, let's say, all the platelets have a very strong potential to push the proliferation and the migration of mesenchymal cells. So that was a very actually exciting period. But the problem was that it's not so easy. And then actually the clinicians overall were a bit frustrated because the clinical success was not so clear. It was not so obvious. And it was very hard to define good, reliable endpoints. So overall, the PRP at that time in dentistry was moved further. It was a kind of flat tire at that time. We were very frustrated, as you can imagine. So then actually came the simple approach originally proposed by Joseph Chocron, simply taking a blood in a tube that supports coagulation, do a little bit of centrifugation, wait, and take the yellow part and name that PRF. So no citrate, no two-step approaches, rather cheap, accessible. And I think this this opened the door for the clinical success of the PRF
Thank you, Reinhard. I think you beautifully explained how it evolved throughout the years. And as you mentioned, so basically we started more or less 30 years ago, but as you said, probably it was in the past 10 years or so that it gained again quite the spotlight because of PRF, as you mentioned. But something I find interesting to discuss is that they're obviously all totally autologous products because they are made of our own blood. But we know from plastic studies that, you know, our own blood clot is already a kind of perfect mix of growth factors, cells, and molecules that can by themselves trigger the healing cascade. So my question is, what's more in these platelet concentrates? Because maybe it has to do with the consistency, because you can make plugs and membranes with these PRP and PRFs, or it has to do maybe with this high concentration of platelets, cells, and growth factors. So what is your experience? What are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, I think the question is, how does PRF work and how does PRP work? I mean, why is it better than a blood clot? Why yeah. are we doing mm-hmm. all these centrifugation steps? Is it necessary? And most of our colleagues, and including us, we all measure the growth factors released by the platelets, PDGF, DGF beta, and we consider this as a basic for to describe the activity and the potential of the PRF, and we consider these parameters to compare the different protocols to prepare PRF, the G forces, the time, and also if you prefer a horizontal or a fixed angulation centrifuge, and all these measures actually are surrogate parameters. And how they impact the clinical success. The clinical success, actually, this is what we want. It's not so clear. So we measure something, it's nice, it's easy to measure, but the translation is something we have not a clear opinion on that. So actually, the question arises, do we need to centrifuge the blood at all? No, we need the centrifugation. I think yes, and I will tell you why. But before, I have to share a kind of interesting story.
Yes, please.
We wanted to compare the blood clot with the PRF, because in all the research you read today, the PRF is wonderful. It stimulates the proliferation and whatever. But the control is always nothing. The control is always a kind of serum-free medium, or so the proper control would be the blood clot. And this is neglected, so it is ignored. So of course you have a victory when you don't have to compete. So we have done a comparison of the blood clot, the lysate, with the PRF lysate in vitro. And we discovered that both the blood clot lysate and the PRF lysate are equivalent. They are wonderful in pushing TGF-beta response in cells. They have a lovely, if you can say lovely in research, but it's a very nice anti-inflammatory activity in vitro. Now you can say, yeah, but then I don't need my centrifuge. But that's not true. We need to centrifuge because we have to remove the erythrocytes. Why do we have to remove the erythrocytes? Because they affect the stability of the fibrin-rich matrix. The mechanical stability of the fibrin matrix is impaired by the presence of erythrocytes. So clinically, you cannot handle the membrane. It's not stable. It's not, let's say, consistent. So I think removing the erythrocytes and the centrifugation is particularly relevant to prepare solid, nice PRF membranes that are mechanically stable. And of course, if you have a red membrane and you use this clinically, it doesn't look nice. No, it looks like a hematoma and it's red, and this is not what you want. So also for, let's say, cosmetic purposes, it's nice to remove the erythrocytes. But from a, let's say, from the cell response, also the blood clot is very, very potent.
Okay, thank you very much. I learned new things, so thank you very much.
It's so much to what we could mention is because the question is what is good in the PRF, no? And if you talk to platelet people, they say, the platelets are easily activated, they're very fast activated. So even when you draw the blood and you look at the platelets, they're activated. And what does platelet activation mean? Mm-hmm. They not only release the content of their granules, they also become very sticky. They become very sticky. And they are a glue for the fibrin mesh. So the platelets are very, very potent in increasing the mechanical stability of the PRF membrane. So they bind it together. So it's so that the platelets is more than just growth factors. They are very, I think that the PRF membrane is more than a source of growth factors. It's a lovely scaffold. It's a scaffold the cells like. The cells can immigrate, like in, physiologic blood clot, but with the advantage of this solid, mechanically stable scaffold. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the secrets of PRF, the scaffolding.
Yeah. No, I mean, thank you very much, because you pointed out the importance of understanding all these cellular mechanisms. And I think you gave us also a bit better or deeper understanding about the basics. And I do have another question, and it goes like, when we talk to another key players, the leukocytes. So what I understood so far is the main differences between the first and the second generation project is the presence or not the presence of leukocytes, isn't it? And then can you maybe tell us a bit more about the role of these cell types in the wound healing when we just go a bit more to the leukocytes?
Yeah, the discussion gets more challenging. Huh?
Yes, we need to challenge you a bit.
Please don't expect a clear answer. Hmm? But I can give you some numbers and some ideas, let's say, and some thoughts. In the PRP, which I think is more easy to understand because it's anticoagulated blood, so you can easily follow the leukocytes. Huh? You have around, let's say, 15 to 20,000 leukocytes per microliter. Sounds much, but in the regular blood, you have around 6 to 7,000 leukocytes. So approximately 2 to 3-fold increase. Mm-hmm. Is this a lot? I don't know. But anyhow, it's an increase. So then what is leukocytes? Leukocytes is white blood cells. Wonderful. But that's not the whole story. I mean, the leukocytes, they have the myeloid lineage, which we know as neutrophils, for instance, or monocytes, and then the lymphoid part, the T cells, the B cells, the natural killer cells. And based on my literature search, there is in this PRP, at least, 70% lymphocytes, 70% B, T, and NK cells, so mainly the lymphocytes, and 20% monocytes and 10% neutrophils. So we have to think about what the B and the T cells are doing. Huh? But nevertheless, the question is, do the neutrophils do harm, or are there, let's say, of any disadvantage? Maybe the blood clot is a good teacher. Not only that the normal blood clot contains all the blood cells and, of course, the leukocytes, but also the blood clot, in particular the chemokines released by the platelets, they are very attractive for neutrophils. So the neutrophils, if they smell the chemokines, they like to immigrate. They want to immigrate. They need to immigrate into the blood clot. And there are diseases where the neutrophils are not capable of moving. And then this is a disease. This is a pathologic condition. So the neutrophils have a potent role in regeneration. And the same is true for the monocytes. I mean, the monocytes come later. Okay, they need a bit more time than the neutrophils. That's fine. And then once the monocytes come and they differentiate into macrophages, and we all know macrophages today is a plasticity issue. We have polarization switches. We have this, what we call the ugly, the pro-inflammatory M1 macrophages and the resolving and more, regenerative M2 macrophages. Now, it is the local environment that defines their, decision if they become more inflammatory or a resolving macrophage. And in a physiologic situation, the macrophages can even switch from a pro-inflammatory towards a resolving. Same cells sometimes. So once the job is done in the M1, they become M2 to support the healing. So I think that we have to be very, sensitive about the discussion to say yes and no to leukocytes and whether they are important or not. I think it also depends on the indication. I mean, if you have a, let's say, a autologous product and you want to inject it in the eye and say, okay, this is a kind of ophthalmologic application, maybe we have to consider the presence of leukocytes differently than in a, let's say, extraction socket. So the discussion needs to be refined and more, let's say, depending on the environment. If you have a biofilm, macrophages will not become M2 because they like this LPS and all these toxins. They will become pro-inflammatory. So if you have a quiet environment and normal, I think the leukocytes is something that we should even welcome.
I also kind of
but
like
you see, it's,
now...
a, it's a hypothesis. No, what I'm talking is maybe convincing, but still, it's a hypothesis. So,
yeah, yes, yeah. I mean, I really was listening to what you said, and I was reflecting on this, and totally makes sense that the local environment is what plays a role. So it's difficult to, you know, sometimes speak in black and white because it's not like that. It's not what happens in biology. So thank you for that very insightful comment. And going further on this direction, you mentioned earlier about the erythrocytes and the challenge that we face in dealing with erythrocytes. But do you think that it's absolutely crucial to keep them completely away? Because you said it before that it looks like they can impair the stability of the matrix. But I also think that it's not that much research in this respect. So maybe something that you think should be further investigated in the future or not?
You know, researchers sometimes ask very simple questions. The question is, what is the role of the erythrocytes in wound healing? No, it's a simple question. The answer is, we don't know. Unbelievable. We have no idea. The most of the research on erythrocytes is, of course, from hematology. It's called a hemorrhage. No? So the erythrocytes need to be replaced after, I don't know, 120 days by the liver, and then they are removed and we get fresh erythrocytes. Wonderful. But in a wound healing situation, we have not much of an idea, but at least a little bit. And of course, the erythrocytes, they contain hemoglobin and heme, and this is important for oxygen transport, that's clear, but they are toxic. So if they are released from a necrotic cell, this is a toxic substance. Good. Then the evolution is not stupid. Macrophages understand that, and they come and try to digest the injured erythrocytes and neutralize somehow the hemoglobin. Good. No, that's good news. But nature is usually more smart than we think. And the macrophages doing this job, they have a special name. They are a kind of erythrocytes phagocytosing macrophages. They become a kind of M2 macrophages. So they have some concept of supporting regeneration. They are pro-resolving. So that means we should not be afraid of erythrocytes. If you have a kind of contamination, it might even be of, let's say, a bit of an advantage to have them in the PRF. And also, we should not forget that the erythrocytes are very rich in an enzyme called catalase. This is an enzyme that removes oxidative stress, hydrogen peroxide. So in evolution, nothing is really stupid. So based on at least this weak evidence we have from other fields, I think we should not be afraid of the erythrocytes. And the transition of the yellow part and the red part in the PRF or in the PRP. This is the most richest area fraction for all cells, also the platelets. So if we ignore this, let's say, transition, the Buffy code song, we, I think, would make a kind of mistake to the yield of cells is much lower if we would, let's say, ignore this.
Yeah, I think you pointed out very interesting aspects, and also kind of not to be afraid about the different cell types. And also you explained very nicely the role of all these different cells. And regarding the time of our podcast, I think Elena has another very interesting question regarding, like, can we just have centrifuges and just tubes, and then we are like we're having our home kit to do our own?
Yeah, exactly, because I was reading some articles explaining how the correct tubes are so crucial, at least it looks like they are crucial for the right preparation of the platelet concentrates. And I know that there is some debate about, for instance, the silica-coated tubes, because silica particles may probably shed from the inner surface of the tube during centrifugation. So can you tell us a little bit more about this kind of technical aspect? So how important it is to have the right tubes and the right, I don't know, centrifuge in order to be able to correctly prepare this kind of products?
Actually, I think you already gave the answer. If you have, I mean, plastic tubes are cheaper than glass tubes. Mm-hmm. If you do some coating of the plastic tubes with silica or silicone, it's much cheaper than a kind of rough surface glass tube and so on. So I think that's clear. And I mean, we need to stimulate the coagulation. So somehow there needs to be a surface where, let's say, this coagulation cascade is initiated. That's fine. But we don't want to have plastic or silicate in our wound healing procedure. I mean, I can imagine this is not what makes M2 differentiation. This is what the macrophages eat and say, wow, that's terrible. I mean, you might even induce an inflammation or a fibrous tissue formation. So hence, it's important not to take the tubes that are sold to prepare serum. This is what we call the serum tubes. No, if you have a blood analysis, you go to a company and buy the serum tubes. They push the coagulation, you centrifuge, and then you send the serum to the laboratory. But this is definitely not what we want in PRF preparation. So what Rick Myron always suggests is to make the water test. So if you have tubes at home, you put some water inside, shake it, and if it makes some bubbles and it looks a bit like milky, obviously there is something inside you don't like to put into your patient. So just be careful about this.
It also means that probably not necessarily everyone can have access to all these kind of refined tubes. And this is an aspect that probably is also relevant because,
But in this case, this is a kind of suggestion, but in this case, I would take a plastic tube, like to be used for the liquid PRF, no? Just a hydrophobic, very, very cheap plastic tube, not fancy. Company doesn't matter really because it's just a plastic tube. And then wait for the coagulation to occur. It just takes longer. And if you like, you can actually put some calcium chloride inside and maybe thrombin. But so if you're not in a hurry, add some calcium chloride, wait, I don't know, half an hour, 37 degree, open the lid, oxygen, and you will also get the kind of PRF membrane, maybe not that strong, maybe not that fast. But if you have the if you have to choose between a fast procedure with silicate and silicone, and you have a, let's say, slow procedure without that, I would go for the slow motion picture.
It sounds so easy. Anyway, everything you explained in this podcast, I know from when I speak for myself, everything about this topic for me is complex, and you made it very easy to understand. And I really thank you that you were here as a guest, and at least for me to make it more understandable, this topic. And yes. I mean, I really liked how you discuss with honesty and also with your opinion about these things. And I think it's greatly appreciated for by many of us who were listening or who will listen to this episode.
Absolutely. Yes. I also, you know, I always find it so fascinating to listen to you because you have this kind of very broad knowledge. And as Anina said, you have this rare quality to make things easy to understand. So thank you very much for taking the time to reflect with us and discuss with us about this very hot topic. It's a true privilege for us. And I'm sure all the listeners will really appreciate it as well.
Yeah, but you know, actually, if the secret of success in research is passion and enthusiasm and the willingness to share, because we are professors, we want to share knowledge, and we also want to discuss some things that are at the hypothesis level. Not all is evidence, but we need this kind of knowledge to move the field forward. Because if we only do the clinical research, it's a try and error approach. We need to go a bit more into the mechanism and then maybe refine a few things that turn out to be more successful in the clinic. And I think if I want, please give me 1 minute to mention this, the PRF and let's say the platelet and fibrin research has a long history in Austria, very long history. It was Helen Matras, actually a maxillofacial surgeon, female, who was one of the inventors of the fibrin glue in the, I think it was in the 80s. And she developed the fibrin glue. Imagine this. Of course, the fibrin glue, the fibrinogen concentration is much too high. It's 20-fold higher than a physiologic blood clot, and they put aprotinin inside in factor 13. So it's definitely not what you want to support regeneration. But for gluing, it's wonderful. So actually, I have a strong emotion to follow also this path from Matras and others who from our small Austrian community help on a global level to make health and regeneration better than it was before. And for this opportunity to share this knowledge, actually, I think you, Anina, and Elena, and also the Osteology Foundation for setting up this lovely broadcast. And if anybody wants to visit me and us in Vienna, please, you will find open doors, just to have mentioned that.
They will. Okay. Now you made an invitation. No, thank you very much, Reinhard. We really feel that you are passionate about everything. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Cheers. Bye.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of the Next Regeneration Podcast by the Osteology Foundation. If you're enjoying the show, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. This helps others find the show, and we greatly appreciate it. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll catch you in the next episode.